Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And what you leave behind says you were here. Do you ever think about that? A couple of treatments of this idea this hour. At the end of the hour, a very big idea. When did humanity start having irreversible effects on the planet? We want to believe that we are permanent. We all do. One of the terrifying consequences of the Pacific cyclone we've been hearing about all week is how it has eradicated whole villages, nothing left. In the fighting in the Middle East we've seen over the past few weeks, it's been a war on ancient artifacts as Islamist forces in Syria and Iraq strike at ancient Mesopotamian pre-Islamic archaeological sites as if by destroying them, they can be erased from history itself. In Iraq, another such battle for the traditionally Sunni city of the late Saddam Hussein, Tikrit, has been a war over symbolic landmarks. That war could determine how well, or if at all, the invasion of ISIS has brought Iraqis together or blown them into permanently warring sects.
ISIL is a direct outgrowth of al-Qaeda in Iraq that grew out of our invasion, which is an example of unintended consequences, which is why we should generally aim before we shoot.
President Obama talking about the legacy of U.S. involvement in Iraq in an interview broadcast this week with Vice Media's Shane Smith. In the battle to retake the city of Tikrit from ISIS fighters, the tomb of Saddam Hussein was virtually leveled, pictures torn down and replaced by Shiite militia flags and photos of militia leaders. What does this signify? Tom Rogan is a columnist for the National Review and a panelist on the McLaughlin Group on PBS. He joins me now. Tom Rogan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you, John. Thank you.
There does appear to be a battle over symbols of what gets determined as history in the Middle East, whether we're talking about archaeological sites or Saddam Hussein's grave. All these attacks on symbols are likely to inflame sectarian tensions. How do you see what's going on?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. But I think part of what is happening with these, with the appropriation of, as you say, symbols by different sectarian groups is the intent to actually purify the land, right? That the actors doing this, whether it be an array of Shia militias around Tikrit or the Islamic State in terms of its actions against majority Shia settlements and ancient artifacts and monuments and memorials, all of this is centered in the belief by various groups that they alone hold the keys to reality, to political reality, but also to historic reality. And that it does show the level of religious and social background to what is happening here. It's not specifically political in a kind of Western sense.
In the battle for Tikrit, because it was Iraqi forces fighting alongside Shia militia, I would have thought that the battle tested the solidarity that might have existed between these two, and that Sunnis in Iraq might see the retaking of Tikrit as a kind of a favor that the Shia were doing for the Sunni to step away from the fighting that had taken place in 2006, etc. But the desecration of this grave makes me think that no, in fact, the bitterness is still just as there as and real as it's ever been.
Right. I mean, I think there would be a pretty good groundswell of people around Tikrit, again, who would have actually, and again, you'll find this when eventually the Iraqi army goes into Mosul, Sunnis who would have welcomed the fact to have been liberated from the kind of absolutism of the Islamic State. The difficulty, of course, is that when these Shia militias go in, a lot of them tend to exceed the basic actions of security, that they then go and either try and, again, appropriate land of Sunni families, that they try and marginalize Sunni families, that they try and do things that are designed to show their sectarian power. Again, the attack on symbols is the best example. But the difficulty is, unless there is a unified force in the form of the Iraqi military and a cross-sectarian governance structure, that actually has the respect of people, regardless of their baseline sectarian identity, all these things will continue to multiply. And, you know, it is not sectarianism per se, but it's the politicization of sectarianism. It's certain groups that identify themselves in wholly sectarian terms, trying to force Sunni, Shia, different sects of both Kurds and other minorities to identify themselves based on those sort of primary identities rather than as Iraqis, rather than as citizens of, again, Tikrit or Mosul. And so that is the great challenge.
Well, let's take as a best case scenario that the desecration of the Saddam Hussein grave was the act of outlier vandals, and that in a sense this first battle is a sign of some level of solidarity. What's going to be tested as that same force goes into Mosul, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, if you look, the history of Mosul is one of which there have always been some pretty significant tensions between, again, that sort of politicized sectarianism issue, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Kurds earlier on. The problem will be that I tend to think these Shia militias, again, they'll do the same thing. They will marginalize Sunni communities there. But the best case scenario is that the Iraqi military, that there are some effective Iraqi military units, especially on the sort of more special forces line level, if they are given the lead there and the Iranian-supported militias are marginalized, then there is a better opportunity for some kind of, you know, positive to come from this. And again, and what will also be important is the kind of representation that the Iraqi government puts into Mosul after the city is taken back. And what I mean by that is, what kind of people, what kind of public service officers are there? Do they have a reputation for being relatively fair arbiters and managers, or do they have a reputation as a sectarian actor? So that will be the distinguishing factor.
You've mentioned, and we've seen, Iran has a good deal of influence in this military operation right now. Do you think Iran wants the sectarian tensions inflamed, or wants a more secularized city hall, government working for the people scenario in the next few months?
The difficulty is with the groups they're supporting and with the ideological fervor that they present from, the guardianship of the jurists, which is the Iranian ideology under Khomeini, it's very, very difficult for them to actually restrain even their own political strategy. In the longer term, there is a difficulty, and the Obama administration is going to have to be astute to that, regardless of what happens with the nuclear negotiations. That doesn't, of course, mean that you sort of go to war with Iran, but it does mean that you have a sort of eyes-open approach to knowing that Iran is not going to be an unrestrained, positive partner in Iraq's political development, that they will have to be compelled in certain ways.
Tom Rogan, columnist for the National Review and panelist on the McLaughlin Group on PBS. Tom, thanks so much.
John, thanks.
Moving west now from ISIS setbacks in Syria to a very active Western front in Libya. This week, ISIS fighters clashed with local militias in the coastal city of Sirte between Benghazi and the Libyan capital of Tripoli, and reports emerged that terrorist groups kidnapped as many as 20 medical workers at a hospital in the city during an attack on that facility. Joining me from Tunis is Ambassador Michael Aron, the British ambassador to Libya. You're in Tunis because of the violence to some extent. Is that correct, Ambassador?
That's right, yes. We evacuated our embassy in Tripoli last August. We are effectively refugees here in Tunis.
Do you regard the fighting in Libya as a Western front in ISIS's attempt to acquire territory?
I don't think so yet. I mean, we have to be very careful with ISIS. They have their own aims, and we must make sure that we treat it on, we look at it on our terms. I think the most important thing in Libya is to resolve the political disputes between the various factions, which is what the UN are doing. And once we have a national unity government, that government can then start tackling ISIL. The most important issue in Libya is the political process and not the threat from ISIL at the moment. But we clearly are watching ISIL with great concern. It has been expanding over the last 6 months. We've seen them go from, I think, sort of local wannabes, this was the latest fad amongst extremists, We've then seen the ISIL central from Iraq and Syria taking more control over their sort of supporters in Libya and sending people back from Iraq and Syria, and indeed sending leaders from Iraq to preside over this new front, as you describe it. And of course, in the last few months, we've seen some terrible, in January, the attack on the Corinthia Hotel, in February, the murder of the Egyptian Copts, and as you say, recently, some kidnapping. So it is expanding, but we need to keep it in proportion and work out how we deal with it the best we can.
Ambassador Aaron, do you think that the political divisions between the groups in Benghazi and the groups in Tripoli can ever be resolved here? And will they both share the oil wealth in Libya effectively to get a secular Libya off the ground?
I definitely think they can resolve their differences. I've been in Libya for 2 years, but it's clear to me that Libyans are a single people. They have regional differences, just like in the States or in the UK, but they are intermarried, interrelated. They have friendships across the country, and in my view, the differences between the 95 or even more percent of Libyans who are moderate, conservative Muslims who want a democratic and free and prosperous state can live and work together, but they need help resolving their differences, which 40 years of dictatorship under Gaddafi have significantly complicated and made it very hard for everybody to work out how to resolve differences peacefully.
You described yourself a moment ago as a refugee. When do you expect that refugee status to end?
Well, I mean, we need a national unity government for so many things, for tackling ISIL, for restoring security, for getting the economy back on track, but also to enable the diplomatic missions to return to Tripoli. Because at the moment, there is a government in Tripoli which we don't recognize and would be complicated. You know, they would be constantly trying to work with us, and we would find that embarrassing because, you know, it's not that we don't like these people, it's just we don't think they are the legitimate government. So until that issue is resolved and we have a government that we can all work with, we're not going to be back.
Ambassador Michael Aaron is the British ambassador to Libya. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The ambassador spoke with us from Tunis. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have overwhelmed the Veterans Administration healthcare system. A problem became evident as millions of deployed and injured soldiers were coming into a system that had been used to dealing with largely geriatric care and substance abuse care from World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. After reports confirmed a number of deaths had been blamed on long wait times and poor record keeping at the VA, Secretary Eric Shinseki resigned his post. President Obama then appointed Robert McDonnell, the retired chairman, president, and CEO of Procter & Gamble.
I'm determined to take business practices and apply them to government and make them work. And I think so far with what we've done, the changes we've made, the improvements we've seen, it works.
Part of the reforms signed into law in late 2014 included the Veterans Choice Card program to give veterans the choice of care outside of the overloaded VA system. Patricia Murphy is reporting on military and veterans issues as part of a public radio collaboration between KUOW in Seattle, KPCC in California, and WUNC in North Carolina. Patricia's first questions were about this Veterans Choice Card.
What this choice card is supposed to mean to veterans who qualify for the program is that if they can't get an appointment within 30 days, a medically necessary appointment within 30 days from the VA, they are supposed to be able to call the choice program administrator in their area and get connected with outside care. Also, if they live 40 miles as the crow flies from a VA facility, they should be able to, again, call that number on the program card and get connected with care locally in their community.
That sounds simple enough, but what's actually happening in practice?
Well, the 40-mile rule is particularly vexing for veterans because the crow flies doesn't make much sense to a veteran who lives, say, 38 miles from a facility, but they have to drive a long way around to get to that facility because of either the way the roads run, or in our case, for our veterans up in San Juan County, they have to take a ferry.
Everyone at the hospital thinks that we're covered if we have to take a ferry. There's quite a few people I talk to at the VA that think that. So people don't know what's really happening.
That is 89-year-old Gloria Heppner, and she is a veteran, a Navy wave, actually, from World War II, who lives up in San Juan County in Friday Harbor, which is in North Puget Sound here, outside of Seattle. She automatically qualifies for the program because of that ferry rule. Now, in her case, she had a heart attack and was told by people at the hospital, because they know this choice program is active, that she should qualify. And in fact, she was one of the veterans who was told, no, no, I'm sorry, this program does not apply to you.
When I talked to the lady that's the intermediary, she says, I have to cancel that appointment. It's not proper. And then when you get okayed with choice, you call them and make another appointment.
She sounds pretty frustrated. Am I wrong there?
Well, it's interesting because Gloria Heppner is of a generation of people who do not complain, right? What she's concerned about is that she is low income. She cannot afford to pay outside for her care. She's worried about the other veterans in the San Juan Islands. Most of them are at least Vietnam era. They should qualify for this program. Her concern is that she needs to get this care. She wants this appointment next month. She's being told to cancel it, and she's worried.
And she's not the only one that's worried.
The message that the veteran hears is, we can't help you. So I think that's really the frustrating part.
And that's John Beckham, who's director of health plan management services at Puget Sound VA. Is the Veterans Administration itself frustrated with the way the federal government is administering this program?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, because, of course, there are members of Congress who say that this bureaucratic issue that is going on within this program is part of a long-standing problem that the VA has with allowing people to go outside of its system. Some people say it's just growing pains. You know, certainly the VA is doing what it can at this point to try to get the correct veterans connected with their medical records to get outside care and to help people like Gloria.
I mean, part of the theory here is that veterans need to be able to go out of network, in quotes, to take advantage of healthcare facilities that, you know, aren't so backlogged like the VA is. And that was the headline, you know, almost a year ago, where there were all these problems with vets spending, you know, hours and hours and weeks waiting for care. But this doesn't necessarily answer the problem here.
No, at least in its current form, it is not answering the problem. And the other side of this VA Choice Act is that certain VAs, like Puget Sound VA, got a lot of money to hire new doctors. So the idea is that while the VA hires enough people to care for patients within the network, we will allow them to go outside of the network till we can, you know, synergize the amount of doctors we need to provide this care. It is not playing out that way right now.
And as you see the problems, are these problems with the providers? Are these problems with the federal administrators? Is it a problem with the veterans themselves not having the right information?
This card was provided to every single U.S. veteran in the VA system. It didn't matter if they qualified for choice care or not. They all got cards, which was a problem. The VA is having issues getting the records for the veterans who need choice care to the program's administrator, TriWest. TriWest is fielding what they're saying is 10,000 calls a day from veterans, and they're trying to get this program up and running as well. You know, a lot of what I'm hearing from the VA and from TriWest is Congress's timeline for this rollout was too short.
What are politicians saying about this? Because, you know, senators and congressmen really jumped in to try to make sure that veterans were getting the services that they need. Who's watching this program roll out?
This was Congress's answer to the Phoenix VA scheduling scandal, right? This was a program that was built out of the ire of Congress at what was going on within the VA. So at this point, I'm hearing pretty much from every district, senators and congressmen saying, I'm still getting phone calls from veterans who are not getting connected to the care that they need. Why is this so difficult?
The problem is when you call, you're often told you don't qualify. You're not on our list, but then there's nothing a veteran can do about to say, wait a minute, I can't, I should be, I am. And the end result is our veterans are still waiting.
That's Kansas Senator Jerry Moran. Is there anything he can do about this here?
Well, you know, they're all following this. And the word on the street is that the VA is asking in its current budget right now to reallocate some of this VA Choice Care money as it sees fit. And this is really irritating some members of Congress. Some of them are saying this is a complete non-starter. You will not reallocate this money.
Tricia Murphy, reporter at KOW in Seattle, focusing on military affairs and veterans issues and seeing some serious veteran frustration with the Veterans Choice Program. Thanks, Patricia.
Thanks, John.
The Takeaway is supported by ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at shopkeep.com.
I would just like to say good luck to Mark Zuckerberg and company. On Monday, the social media giant Facebook, with 1.4 billion users worldwide, released their updated community standards. Among these standards, no bare genitals on Facebook, no revenge porn on Facebook, no attacks on race on Facebook, ethnicity, national origin, religion, sexual orientation, gender, and, quote, serious disabilities. Jeffrey Rosen is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and professor at George Washington University Law School. He's with us now. Jeffrey, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back.
So my reaction here is, and you've dabbled into this a little bit, is, you know, many have tried to create a coherent free speech community standards doctrine. And Zuckerberg thinks he's going to do what the Supreme Court hasn't been able to do in 230 years.
Well, what's really so interesting is that Mark Zuckerberg right now has more power than over free speech than any king or president or Supreme Court justice. And what he and Facebook and Google and Twitter decide are the community standards have more to shape who can speak and who can be heard than any American judge. So it's hugely important what he's deciding.
Well, there's two issues here. One, the standards themselves, how do they work? But there's nothing illegal here because he's a corporation, can do what he wants. But then there's the question of how, by virtue of the momentum of $1.4 billion users, does that essentially create a template for even governmental structures? Let's begin with the standards themselves. Do you think they work?
Well, in some cases they do, in some cases they don't. A good example of them working was the Innocence of the Muslim video. Remember, President Obama and the President of Egypt about a year ago were urging Facebook and Google to remove the video on the grounds that it supposedly caused the riots in Benghazi. Facebook and Google decided not to because both of them allow criticism of religious leaders but don't allow criticism of religion as a group. In other words, you can say, I hate Muhammad, but you can't say, I hate Muslims. And because the video supposedly criticized the prophet, it was left up. In retrospect, that was a better decision than President Obama wanted to make, given the contested questions of whether or not the video actually caused the riots.
The whole idea of what constitutes religious offense can't really be appealed here. You can't go to Zuckerberg's assistant at Facebook and say, you know, we want to appeal this.
You can't. They make the standards, and there's no appeal. And the distinctions that they're drawing, again, it's not like they can work in practice, but they're kind of Jesuitical. The new standards allow for photos of breastfeeding, but don't allow for bare nipples and pornography. And it just we can quibble over the standards. Some people think they're in the right place, and others that they're in the wrong. But it's not accountable, and it's not always transparent. Now, the new standards try to be more transparent by giving specific examples of stuff that's illegal and, or rather, impermissible and stuff that isn't. So they're definitely moving in a more transparent direction. But the broad question is the one that you raised at the beginning, which is, are we comfortable with allowing these private corporations to draw distinctions over free speech that affect nearly half of the users in the world?
Is the 1.4 billion users of Facebook a natural template for governmental structures on free speech? Will we have to go with what Facebook goes with?
Well, yes, in the sense that everyone's on Facebook. Nearly half of the world's on Facebook. But that doesn't mean that governments can't impose their own standards. Facebook has to obey the laws of the country in which it operates. So it removes Holocaust denial material in France and Germany where that's illegal, or criticisms of Kemal Ataturk in Turkey where that's illegal. And it's constantly, like Google and Twitter, struggling with requests from foreign governments, trying to decide when to push back and when not to. In other words, when the request is really an attempt to suppress political speech and when it isn't. It's just a huge power that we're investing in these private companies.
Jeffrey Rosen is president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and professor at George Washington University Law School. In a panel discussion this weekend at South by Southwest, Rosen urged Twitter and Facebook to allow just as much free speech as the U.S. government permits under the First Amendment. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
It is a universal idea that we contemplate as individual humans. What do we leave behind? What evidence was there left behind that we were here, aside from our poignant yearning to be forever remembered?
These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits and are melted into air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea.
This sadness over our phantom human lives, our impermanence, is something Shakespeare wrote about in his play The Tempest, written at the beginning of the 1600s, just when human beings were beginning to collectively leave their irreversible marks on this earth, way before global warming. The human population of the globe was mixing with massive biological consequences. According to the latest geological research, the Anthropocene period, the era of humans, first big clunky footprints on Earth, begins in 1610.
This date has a resonance because in the 16th century, because of Christopher Columbus discovering the Americas, what we started to do in that century is move species around the planet. And it's the first time that the old world and the new world actually joined together. And so we were moving plants and animals and unfortunately diseases between the continents. And we've called this Orbis because this was the first time the world was joined. And that, if we go 100,000 years into the future and look back, that mixing of biota, which continues to today with ships moving species, invasive species to new locations, that will be the indelible mark that humans left on the Earth.
Professor Mark Maslin is the co-author of a study published in Nature that tries to nail down the moment humans began changing the Earth irreversibly on a mass scale. And the researchers found two strong candidates.
Well, the first thing is we can see in Marine Corps the first appearance of pollen from different species appearing on different continents in the 16th century. But the reason we pick 1610 is because we have the massive shift in biota starting, which is the big Earth shift, but we need a golden spike. And unfortunately, when we annexed the Americas, we also brought over lots of diseases, particularly smallpox. And we find that by the end of the 16th century, nearly 50 million people in South America had actually died due to this disease, due to starvation, and a little bit of genocide. Now, the key thing there is they were all farmers. And so, of course, what happened was the land that they cleared started to grow back natural vegetation, both of forest and also savanna. And we see that signal in the atmospheric carbon dioxide record. So all that carbon dioxide was being drawn out of the atmosphere to regrow this vegetation. And there's a beautiful spike, a dip in the greenhouse gases that we see beautifully focused on 1610. So that gives us the Earth shift, which is all the biota being homogenized across the world, but it also has a beautiful golden spike centered on 1610 that gives you that stratigraphic marker.
Well, beautiful in the sense that it signifies the death of 55 million people, right?
Well, again, it's a interesting viewpoint because what it says is the Anthropocene, our human age, meant that we are doing things because we feel that they're necessary. However, they do have unintended consequences. And moving biota across the different continents, we already now worry about invasive species, killing off local species. But of course, we had no idea that we were going to move killer diseases to a continent that had never actually encountered them before.
But the geologists found another candidate for the Anthropocene era, much later, the 1960s, when you can begin to detect signs of human nuclear shenanigans.
Well, boys, I reckon this is it. Nuclear combat toe-to-toe with the Ruskies.
1964, Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove is released. The other golden spike, says Mark Maslin, the nukes.
the bomb spike. So if you look at ice cores or tree rings and you measure the amount of radiocarbon in them, their radiocarbon increases through their record from the first nuclear explosion in 1945 all the way through to 1963. Now, the nice thing is, in 1963, there was a partial bomb test treaty, which basically limited above-ground nuclear tests. And so the C-14 then dropped away markedly. And that peaks a year later in 1964. So it gives you a beautiful peak, and you can measure it in tree rings around the world. And that symbolizes the middle of the 60s. And the reason why people are interested in the 60s is because Will Seffen has called this the Great Acceleration. Impacts on the world accelerated through the 1960s. Population growth peaked at over 2% per year because we had invented wonderful medicines to prevent children dying prematurely. We were damming all the major rivers, and you see the CO2 and the other greenhouse gases accelerating into the atmosphere through that period of time and continuing to today.
Mark Maslin is professor of geography at University College London and co-author of a new study in Nature on dating humanity's geologic impact on the Earth. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.